Okay, welcome to episode 66 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. This podcast is going to be devoted to pulmonary pharmacology. Basically, if you know everything in this podcast, you know everything you need to know about pulmonary pharmacology for the USMLEs, right? So, and this, I'm going to cover all the drugs in this one podcast. So let's go ahead and begin. So let's start with allergies, right? So we know that allergies are type 1 hypersensitivity reactions, right? So like asthma, for example. And I mean, how do allergies work? So basically, the first thing that happens is you have like your first exposure to an allergen, right? And these allergens are taken up by, you know, like antigen presenting cells like macrophages, B cells, dendritic cells. And then they present these things to CD4 positive T helper 2 cells. Okay, remember, T helper 1 deals more with cell mediated immunity. T helper 2 deals more with antibody mediated immunity. Okay, so and then you make IgM. Okay, and then remember interleukin 4, very high yield to know this. Interleukin 4 helps you class switch to IgE, right? As long as you have those pesky CD40 ligand interactions you talk about in an immunology podcast in the future. Remember, without those interactions, you get a hyper IgM syndrome, right? So, and then the Fc epsilon receptors or mast cells, right? They can bind IgE, okay? And if you have cross-linking of those immunoglobulins and those Fc epsilon receptors or mast cells, you have degranulation, you release histamine bradykinin, and then you have the allergic response. And remember that histamine can cause bronchoconstriction, right? And it also increases vascular permeability because it can cause a contraction of cells known as pericytes, okay? Pericytes sort of surround endothelial cells, so that allows for more space for fluid to flow into the interstitium around blood vessels, right? And histamine also causes vasodilation. Contrast this with bradykinin. Bradykinin is a pyrogen, right? So it causes fever. That's one. Two, it actually also increases vascular permeability, causes vasodilation just like histamine, right? But one high yield thing you kind of want to remember is that bradykinin, right? There are certain things that can break down bradykinin, right? So to like inactive metabolites. One of this is ACE, angiotensin converting enzyme. Another is another enzyme known as a C1 esterase inhibitor. The thing is, if you have a deficiency of C1 esterase inhibitor, right? You have a disease known as hereditary angioedema, right? These people should not take ACE inhibitors because if they already have a deficiency of one enzyme that breaks down bradykinin and then you give them an ACE inhibitor, you kill the other enzyme that breaks down bradykinin, they can get some very, very nasty, nasty, nasty stuff, right? And remember that for bradykinin to do its job, like every molecule in the body, there's a receptor it binds to, there's a bradykinin receptor. So that leads into the first drug I'm going to talk about. It's known as icatibant, I-C-A-T-I-B-A-N-T. It's not in first aid yet, but I can foresee this coming to first aid or the USMLEs at some point in the very near future. So this drug is a bradykinin receptor antagonist, okay? You can actually use it to treat hereditary angioedema again because it blocks those bradykinin receptors. Now, let's talk about the antihistamines, right? So the antihistamines... Basically, for this case, we're talking about the H1 blockers versus GI, where you're dealing with the H2 blockers, right? Then the thing is, for these H1 blockers, you have two generations, right? There's the old school kind, there's the first generation, and then there's the new school kind, the second generation. So the first generation, these ones, they have an awesome ability to cross the blood-brain barrier, okay? But the thing is, these drugs are also powerful muscarinic receptor antagonists. Okay, and some of them also block serotonin receptors. I'll talk about that in a short while. But the classic drugs you need to know here are drugs like diphenhydramine. Okay, remember diphenhydramine, right, is a powerful muscarinic receptor. It's Benadryl, right? But it probably has the most powerful muscarinic receptor blocking properties of all the first generation antihistamines, right? So because it can block muscarinic receptors, it's very sedating, right? It actually kind of works like scopolamine, right? Because again, being a powerful anti-muscarinic, it can actually help with motion sickness. And again, please, because this drug has anticholinergic activity, right? You certainly do not want to use this in the elderly, right? It can cause delirium and it can cause like urinary retention, right? And another awesome thing about diphenhydramine that may show up on a psych question is about a person that's taking a drug for schizophrenia, right? Like an antipsychotic. And then they ask you about like acute dystonia, right? You can actually treat that acute dystonia, right? And some of the Parkinsonism features by giving diphenhydramine. Okay, again, taking advantage of its anti-muscarinic properties, right? Because remember, one of the ways you can treat one of those extrapyramidal symptoms is to give benztropine. Benztropine is a muscarinic receptor antagonist, right? So you can take advantage of all that. Stuff by giving diphenhydramine because it has those same anti-muscarinic properties that you're looking for, right? And then another high yield first generation antihistamine is ciproheptadine, right? The main reason I'm talking about this is it's a serotonin receptor antagonist as well, so you can actually use it to treat a serotonin syndrome. And then there are other high yield antihistamines that are H1 first generation, drugs like dimenhydrinate, like clofeniramine, like promethazine, right? Promethazine, I'll say it's probably used primarily for its anti-emetic properties, but it's also pretty sedating. Now, again, these are first generation H1 blockers. They're used primarily for allergies, but one thing that has actually come out from studies fairly recently is that this drug actually increases risk for Alzheimer's. So I know there are people that take this just chronically to help with sleep. I will encourage you to probably stay away from these drugs, right? At least you don't want to use them like all day, every day for weeks and weeks and weeks and months on end. And it's probably not a good life strategy because, again, kind of think about it, kind of makes sense, right? For Alzheimer's, we use acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, right? So like donepezil, galantamine, rivastigmine to boost acetylcholine levels. So if you're chronically taking a drug that blocks acetylcholine receptors, you can see how that could potentially spell trouble for a person in the future. Now that I've talked about the first generation, I'll just talk about the second generation real quick. These drugs, they cannot cross the blood-brain barrier, right? So because they cannot cross the blood-brain barrier, right, they act primarily in the periphery, and they do not block muscarinic receptors. So the key drugs you want to know here are drugs like loratadine or cetirizine or fexofenadine. And again, these drugs are used for allergies. If a person has chronic allergies, probably makes more sense to take these drugs chronically than to take the first generation antihistamines, given all the side effects they have. Now, the next drug I'll talk about here is dextromethorphan. Dextromethorphan it has many properties, right? So first things first, it's an NMDA receptor blocker, right? And it's also actually a weak mu opioid receptor agonist, right? The main thing this is used for is it's used as a cough suppressant, right? And the thing is, if you take a supraphysiologic doses of this drug, you can actually have a profound respiratory depression, right? Because again, it activates opioid receptors, right? And you could actually reverse this with naloxone. It's just one of those weird high-yield tidbits you want to know for your step one exam. And then the next drug I'll talk about is guafenazine, right? Guafenazine is a mucolytic, right? It's used mainly in cystic fibrosis patients because all that mucus, they sort of cough up, right? It can help you break up that mucus. Now, please do not confuse guafenazine with guanfacine. Okay, guanfacine is a totally different drug. It's an alpha 2 agonist that actually works kind of similar to clonidine. Okay, and it's high yield to remember, right? I've talked about this in a previous podcast, but high yield to remember that guanfacine is used primarily for Tourette's syndrome, right? It's used for Tourette's, because think about it, right? If you release like less norepinephrine, right? Because remember, alpha-2 agonist, the alpha-2 receptor is a GI coupled receptor. So when you activate it, right, you release less norepinephrine, right? So if you release less norepinephrine, that can potentially calm down someone that's kind of agitated, right? So like in Tourette syndrome or even in ADHD, guanfacine is actually also used for ADHD. And while I'm on this tangent, please also don't forget that clonidine is used to treat opioid withdrawal, right? Because it basically works like an opioid, right? Opioids, by binding to mu receptors, they prevent the release of catecholamines. Well, clonidine, by binding to alpha-2 receptors, it prevents the release of norepinephrine, which is a catecholamine, right? So clonidine is actually beginning to become a street drug in many locales. Okay. And I guess while I'm on this guanfacine business, don't forget prazosin, right? Prazosin is an alpha-1 blocker, right? It's used to treat the nightmares associated with PTSD, right? And then don't forget mirtazapine, right? It's an alpha-2 antagonist. It's used to treat depression, but it can cause weight gain, right? So it's very good for like depression in a patient with anorexia nervosa, for example. So again, guaifenesin is a mucolytic, but don't confuse it with these other drugs that have somewhat similar sounding names, but totally different effects. Now, next drug I'll talk about is Dornier's Alpha, okay? Dornier's Alpha, it's used in cystic fibrosis primarily. It sort of breaks up DNA, right, that's made by inflammatory cells in the airway, again, to also help with clearing up secretions. But unlike guaifenesin, right, Dornier's Alpha actually works by breaking up phosphodiester bonds, okay? Now, the next pulmonary drug I'll talk about, it's like ridiculously high yield, right? N-acetylcysteine is almost like a wonder drug because it does so many things, right? Basically, N-acetylcysteine, it's an analog of glutathione, right? It's like reduced glutathione, essentially, right? So it helps a lot with dealing with oxidative stress. So what are the things we use N-acetylcysteine for? And again, I promise you, you need to know all these things for your exam. First thing is you can use it to treat acetaminophen toxicity, right? Because it helps you deal with like NAPQI toxicity, right? I've talked about that pathway in a prior podcast. You can actually also use N-acetylcysteine as prophylaxis against the contrast nephropathy, right? Because again, it'll mop up free radicals in the kidney from contrast. And then in cystic fibrosis patients, because N-acetylcysteine can break disulfide bonds, right? You can actually use it to break up mucus plugs in CF patients. And then another thing that N-acetylcysteine actually does is it can actually be used to treat the hemorrhagic cystitis that's associated with cyclophosphamide, right? Remember that hemorrhagic cystitis is mediated by a metabolite of cyclophosphamide known as acrolein, okay? So, cyclophosphamide metabolized to acrolein. Acrolein is a bad vesicant. It can screw up your bladder, right? So you can sort of prevent that by giving it acetylcysteine to mop up all those free radicals. And while we're on the topic of hemorrhagic cystitis, don't forget that hemorrhagic cystitis can be caused by adenovirus, right? Which can also cause a pharyngoconjunctivitis, right? So like pink eye and sore throat. And don't forget that schistosoma hematobium, right? So if they give you an Egyptian with painless hematuria on your exam, think about hemorrhagic cystitis with schistosoma hematobium. Now, one weird thing I'll just say here, since I'm sort of diving into that topic now, is if step one asks you about the first immunoglobulin that is made when you're exposed to an allergen, resist the temptation to pick IgE. It is actually IgM, right? You need to class switch with IL-4 for you to make IgE. But again, if you're exposed to an allergen, the first immunoglobulin you make is IgM. That is like super, 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 super high yield to know. Now, but after you have, like, say, for example, the second exposure, right, to the allergen, and then that's where you have IgE already, right, because you've had all that class switching and all that fun stuff happen. And the thing is, IgE, right, again, IgE cannot just work in up like on its own, right? It needs to bind the allergen and then bind to the Fc epsilon receptor on mast cells, right? When allergen binds to that IgE, you have cross-linking of those Fc epsilon receptors that causes degranulation of mast cells, right? So if you want to basically prevent that mast cell degranulation that can cause a lot of allergy symptoms, right, or inflammatory reactions that you can see in asthma, for example, you can try to actually block the constant region of IgE by giving a drug like omalizumab, or you can essentially, you know, and again, this is more for prophylaxis, right? Because obviously, if you've been exposed to the allergen already and you don't have the drug on board, you're already kind of screwed, right? But if you have that constant region of IgE already bound, you can use it as prophylaxis, right? You can use it as prophylaxis. Now, alternatively, right, you can also actually, like, this is like a teleologic explanation, but it works. You can actually try to almost, I guess, like suture mast cell membranes together with drugs like nedochromyl or chromolyn sodium. Those drugs are mast cell membrane stabilizers that can be used for the treatment of allergies or prophylaxis against allergies. Now, I'll say some more things about those drugs in a bit, but let me say some things about bronchodilation, right? So there are certain things that can cause airway bronchodilation, right? One thing that can do that is if you activate beta-2 receptors. Remember, right, beta-2 receptors, they are GS-coupled, so cyclic AMP increases. Alternatively, you can just block muscarinic receptors, right? So if you're sort of thinking in reverse with that, right, think about methacholine. Methacholine is a muscarinic receptor agonist. It can be used in a provocative test for asthma, right? And again, let me just state this again. I've kind of mentioned it already, but again, let's just sort of make this very clear. If you increase cyclic AMP, that causes smooth muscle relaxation and bronchodilation. Another thing is, if you actually increase cyclic GMP, you will also get smooth muscle relaxation and bronchodilation, right? And alternatively, if you also blocked leukotriene receptors, right, you can also get bronchodilation, right? That's something that's done in asthma therapy, as you'll see in a bit, right? So, because the thing is, leukotriene actually causes smooth muscle contraction, right? So you can get bronchoconstriction under those circumstances. So what's the pathway to creating leukotrienes, right? The first thing that happens is membrane phospholipids, right? They are converted to arachidonic acid by an enzyme known as phospholipase A2. Remember, phospholipase A2 is actually inhibited by corticosteroids, right? And then arachidonic acid can be converted to leukotrienes by an enzyme known as 5-lipoxygenase, right? And then those leukotrienes that you've produced then act on leukotriene receptors, right? And again, don't forget that the leukotriene receptor is known as the cis-LT1 receptor, okay? It's known as the cis-LT1 receptor. You may say, oh, divine, what are you saying? How can this be high yield for step one? Well, think again. There are actually some receptors that are very high yield to know that you have to like regurg word for word on exams. One is the cis-LT1 receptor, right? That's the leukotriene receptor. Another one is the P2Y12 receptor, right? That's a receptor found on platelets. And then another is the angiotensin II receptor on blood vessels. The angiotensin II receptor is known as the type 1 receptor. So you can see how confusing that is and how likely your friends at the MBME are to sort of test those on exams. So back to leukotrienes, right? I will say that one high-yield leukotriene you probably want to keep at the back of your mind is leukotriene B4. Okay, it's a chemotactic factor for neutrophils, right? Same thing with interleukin 8 and C5a. Those are all chemotactic factors for neutrophils. Now, another thing arachidonic acid can do, right? So I've talked about it. And again, I will mention drugs in a bit, but I just want to walk you through these pathways. Another thing arachidonic acid can do, instead of going down the lipooxygenase pathway to make leukotrienes, is it can also go down the cyclooxygenase or the COX pathway to form prostaglandins, right? So the thing is, let's assume you irreversibly inhibited COX with aspirin, right? You can cause something known as aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease, right? Because, again, by giving aspirin, you kill the COX pathway, so that will increase flux through the LOX or the lipooxygenase pathway, so you make more leukotrienes, right? So that's the potential pathophysiology behind aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. And classically, this disease is associated with nasal polyposis on exams. Now, some other high-yield things that are associated with nasal polyps are things like cystic fibrosis or like Wegener's granulomatosis. I believe that's the thing that's known as a granulomatosis with polyangiitis, right? So that's kind of like one high-yield thing you want to know for exams. So think about this. If you know the pathophysiology behind aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease, then that tells you that, you know what, if increased flux through the lipooxygenase pathway can cause problems, then maybe you should block that lipooxygenase pathway to treat aspirin exacerbated respiratory disease. So you can give drugs like Xyluton, right? That's a lipooxygenase inhibitor. It inhibits the actual enzyme that converts arachidonic acid to leukotrienes. Only problem is Xyluton is not great for your liver, so it's not commonly prescribed. Alternatively, you can block those leukotriene cis-LT1 receptors with drugs like Montelukast and Zerfelukast. Okay, those drugs are actually good for the treatment of AERD. Okay, now let's go to asthma, right? So asthma, I've talked about all the high yield relevant receptors, right? So let's start with asthma treatment, right? So the thing is, for asthma treatment, obviously you want to cause bronchodilation, right? So you can do this in many ways. You can give a beta 2 receptor agonist, as I described already. And those beta 2 receptor agonists can either be short acting, right, like albuterol, or long acting, like just remember San Francisco, like SF, that's salmeterol and formoterol. These beta 2 agonists, right, they're used for asthma. Albuterol, right, you usually use it for like an acute asthma exacerbation because it's short acting, versus salmeterol for moderate. You can use them for chronic asthma therapy, right? They're not going to help you acutely. And then you can also use these beta 2 agonists for the treatment of COPD. And then don't forget that albuterol, by being a beta 2 agonist, it also has the ability to activate the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So you can actually use it as one of the treatments for acute hyperkalemia. Just so that you throw that in there. Now, one weird thing they probably expect you to know for step one is, if you're trying to treat asthma, right, first you need to start with albuterol as needed, right? If that's not controlling symptoms, you then add inhaled corticosteroids. If inhaled corticosteroids are not controlling symptoms adequately, then you add something known as a LABA, a long-acting beta agonist, right? Or you can actually add a leukotriene blocker, right, like montelukast or zafirlukast. So why am I saying this? The thing is, you should never use LABAs as monotherapy. If you use them, there's actually an increased risk of death when you use those drugs as a monotherapy. And then if LABAs and leukotriene blockers are not helping your asthma symptoms, last line in asthma is like the oral steroids, right? So like PO steroids. Now, for asthma, again, to cause bronchodilation, another thing you can do is you just block muscarinic receptors. You can do it in short-acting fashion with drugs like ipratropium, or in long-acting fashion with drugs like tiotropium, right? Remember, kind of easy way to remember that is that T is later than I in the alphabet. So tiotropium should be long-acting, ipratropium should be shorter-acting, right? And again, these drugs are used to treat asthma and COPD. Alternatively, remember I said that an increase in cyclic AMP causes smooth muscle relaxation and bronchodilation. So one thing you can actually do is you can try to boost up cyclic AMP in the smooth muscles of your airway to treat asthma symptoms, right? And one way you can do that is you can inhibit an enzyme known as PDE4, phosphodiesterase 4. Phosphodiesterase 4 is an enzyme that breaks down cyclic AMP, right? So you can do this with drugs like theophylline, right? So theophylline, it can inhibit PDE4, increase your cyclic AMP, and you can actually use this to treat asthma and COPD. The thing is, theophylline also has the ability to block adenosine receptors, okay? Because again, it's a methyl xanthine, right? Kind of like caffeine. So the thing is, if a patient is on theophylline chronically, you cannot use adenosine in those kinds of patients, right, to break a tachyarrhythmia, because it will not work, right, because you've essentially blocked those adenosine receptors, so they will not respond. Okay, now another thing with theophylline is that it can actually increase conduction through the AV node. So contrast this with, I sort of think of theophylline as like the evil twin, or the I think of it as like an adenosine arch rival or something like that, because the thing is, adenosine slows conduction through the AV node. That's how you use adenosine to break tachyarrhythmias, but theophylline actually speeds conduction through the AV node. Okay, that's actually why theophylline can cause tachyarrhythmias. That's why theophylline is not a commonly prescribed medication. And then there are drugs that have the ability to raise your cyclic GMP. There's a drug known as a riociguat. Riociguat, it activates guanylyl cyclase. You can raise your cyclic GMP. You can get smooth muscle relaxation and then bronchodilation. So you can actually use this drug to treat COPD. It's not really used to treat asthma. It's used more for the treatment of COPD. Now, the leukotriene receptor blockers, I've kind of mentioned those already. CCLT1 blockers, montelukast, zafirlukast, these drugs, so there may be a weird thing you may see on step one, or you may read about in books, right, that these drugs are associated with Churg-Strauss syndrome. So the thing is, it's not that these, and again, just to make things clear, Churg-Strauss syndrome, no one really calls it that anymore. Churg-Strauss syndrome is actually known as, EGPA, so eosinophilic, eosinophilic granulomatosis with polyangiitis. That's where basically a person has like granulomas in the lung, they have eosinophilia and they have asthma. The thing is, these drugs, right, they are usually given as steroid sparing agents, right? It's like, oh, you can use these drugs to treat like inflammatory airway disorders, so that you don't have to take steroids, because steroids have all these bad side effects. But the thing is, if a person was already on steroids, those steroids may have been suppressing whatever inflammatory disorder they may have as a sort of like a side benefit to treating whatever airway problems they have. So the thing is, if you then start taking leukotriene receptor blocker like Zafirlocast, Montelukast, you stop taking those steroids, those other inflammatory disorders that a person may have had, like Chuck-Strauss syndrome, that were sort of treated as a side benefit without you even being aware of because you were taking the steroids, they may basically unmask themselves. So that's why there's this association between the leukotriene receptor antagonists, right? Or like, I guess, Xyluton, which is a lipoxygenase inhibitor, and Chuck-Strauss syndrome. So it's one of those weird things you just want to keep in mind, and that's the potential explanation behind why that is the case. Now, I've talked about the mast cell membrane stabilizers, right? So like Cromolyn, Nedochromel, those drugs stabilize the mast cell membrane. You can use them as like asthma prophylaxis or like allergy prophylaxis. And while we're on the topic of like stabilizing membranes of weird stuff, right? One important thing you probably want to know, right? Or sort of correlate, is a drug like calcium gluconate, right? You can use it to stabilize the myocardial membrane, right? If a patient has a hyperkalemia, right? Why am I saying this? You're like, Divine, this doesn't relate. This is a POMA Pharma review. This is not a renal review or anything like that. Here's why I'm wasting time on that. The first thing is, step one may give you a question where they describe something, and then they can say which of the following drugs acts in similar fashion or has a similar mechanism of action to whatever drug they mention in the Q-STEM, right? You want to make that connection that, oh, stabilization of a membrane can be something that can be done by calcium gluconate in the realm of renal or cardio, versus nedochromial and cromolyn that can do the same thing in the realm of pulmonology. So just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then I've talked about omalizumab that is, basically used for the treatment of asthma, especially as prophylaxis, especially in the pediatric population, especially kids that have like cystic fibrosis, right? You don't want them to get like a superimposed like asthma attack or something, right? That can kill them pretty quickly, right? So you can prophylax by giving them omalizumab. And then the last thing I will say on that pulmonology is pulmonary hypertension. Okay, pulmonary hypertension. The classic case here is a young woman, maybe in her 30s, that's having like chronically increased shortness of breath. And then you do an echocardiogram, you'll see like high pressures in the right ventricle. Remember, this is associated with a BMPR2 mutation. I think it's like bone morphogenic protein receptor 2. Okay, it's associated with a BMPR2 mutation, right? So like pulmonary arterial hypertension. So if a person has pulmonary arterial hypertension, well, you can try to treat this by dilating those pulmonary vessels, right? So you can do that with a few drug classes, right? One drug class are like your prostaglandin analogs. Remember, prostaglandins dilate things in general, right? So they can dilate those pulmonary vessels. So drugs like epoprostenol or iloprost or treprostinil can be used for the treatment of pulmonary hypertension. Those drugs all have prost in the name, so they are easy to remember. Alternatively, you can give a PDE5 inhibitor, right? Because remember I told you that PDE4 breaks down cyclic AMP, right? But PDE5 breaks down cyclic GMP. So if you wanted to increase your levels of cyclic GMP and basically treat pulmonary arterial hypertension, you can give a PDE5 inhibitor. Right, because by inhibiting PDE5, your cyclic GMP keeps going up, right, and that can cause smooth muscle relaxation and vasodilation. So you can use drugs like sildenafil and tadalafil. Okay, remember those drugs are used for erectile dysfunction, but you can also actually use those drugs as well for pulmonary hypertension, right? So, but don't forget though, you don't want to give these drugs along with like nitrates, or with hydralazine, or like alpha-methyl-DOPA, or prazosin, right? Because remember that all those drugs are vasodilators, right? So you can cause like life-threatening hypotension if you give those two drugs together. And then, I guess the last drugs I'll talk about are the endothelin receptor blockers. Endothelin is probably the most powerful vasoconstrictor in the body, right? So you can try to treat pulmonary hypertension by giving an endothelin receptor antagonist. You can block, and I mean, there are multiple endothelin receptors. There's like endothelin A, there's endothelin B. So you can block endothelin A receptors by giving a drug like ambrisentan, or you can block both endothelin A and B receptors by giving bosentan. Okay, those drugs are actually used to treat the pulmonary hypertension, but they're like super expensive. So I guess that's the end for me with this pulmonary pharmacology. I hope you find this helpful and useful for your exams. If you have any questions, please don't feel free to send the responses my way. Some people have actually suggested that I try to make my podcast available on like a podcast app or something. Trust me, I've tried. I don't know for some reason. I don't know if it's a software issue or what, but I have tried multiple times and I've not really had any progress with that. Like I always get like some error message or something when I try to add it to like Apple Podcasts. So I will try again when I'm off my ICU rotation. And then I just want to throw this out there. I offer tutoring for many exams, like step one, step two CK, step two CS, and step three. And also offer tutoring for the internal medicine in training exam, and also for the MCAT for certain subjects, not all subjects. And then I also prepare applications, right? So like ERAS applications or like AMCAS applications for med school. And I do like mock interviews. I help with preparing like personal statements and all that stuff. So feel free to reach out to me if you want tutoring for any of those things. I have tons of experience. I've worked with thousands and thousands of students. So just reach out to me and I'll be happy to work on that with you. So I wish you all the best. Have a wonderful night, and I will see you in episode 67. God bless.